As a business owner, it's important to keep your business connected. Spectrum Business is committed to keeping your business online whenever and wherever you need us, all backed by the Spectrum Commitment. Get fast, reliable internet starting at $40 per month when bundled, or level up your internet speed and get a 3-year price guarantee. Learn how Spectrum Business can help your business stay connected at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Chance for afternoon showers if you're headed out to the Jazz Fest or the Zurich Classic. And you may want to keep that in mind as you bring the umbrella or whatever you need to do. It's going to be hot and humid, too, through the weekend. Then it dries out tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday. No chance for showers, but highs near 90. We're going to talk about the 15th anniversary that we just celebrated. Well, not celebrated, recognized, I guess, of the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. And here to discuss is Brian Roberts, Executive Director and Chief Scientist at LUMCON, Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. You know, I was saying that when it first happened, I was talking to Plaquemines Parish President Billy Nungesser the morning after it happened. We had no idea what was ahead of us. Nobody had any idea. So when it comes to the 15 years later, do we still know the impacts of the Deepwater Horizon blowout?
I think we know a lot of the impacts, but I think we're still learning more. The more we're able to compile the data that we've had and the fact that there are still some of the impacts we're still seeing, and we don't know exactly how long some of them may persist.
Will we ever?
I think we will. There's been oil spills in the past that have been well studied. There was a spill in the early 70s in off of Cape Cod that, you know, they were still finding impacts up to 30, 40 years later of that spill. So it really depends on the system. You know, different systems are more susceptible than others. And, you know, the magnitude of this spill is something that was somewhat unprecedented. We'll have to see exactly how long some of these impacts persist.
You know, one thing I learned as I speak to you here is that when we were talking about tar balls washing up on the beach and so forth. Is it Dr. Roberts, by the way?
Yes, it was.
Well, Dr. Roberts, one thing that I did learn about tar, you know, is tar balls, that oil is constantly seeping up from the lake, and I think a lot of people didn't realize that. Certainly nothing like the Deepwater Horizon. What are some of the things that the Deepwater Horizon revealed to the general public that perhaps you knew that other people didn't? Things like that.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons why oil and gas is located here is because we have these natural seeps that are offshore. Some of the most productive oil lands on the planet are located in this area. But oil is part of this environment. One of the things that we learned is that when you take soil samples from the marsh, that most of the marsh has some low levels of oil history in its exposure. You know, some of that is from the oil that's in this area. Some of it is from the human activities that are here. That's just part of where we are. I mean, you know, we have an oil spill coordinator's office for a reason. I think that sometimes it takes these really large events for people to realize, you know, something that's kind of going on in the background all the time.
nothing of that scope has happened since, right? Even close to it?
No, nothing of that scope has happened since.
And could that be cause and effect because of some of the things that were put into place after this happened?
Well, I think every time an incident of this magnitude or close to this magnitude happens, obviously there's a lot of precautions and things that take place. I mean, there have been events that happened, and actually the whole research program that was developed, the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, or GOMRI, which was a 10-year, $500 million research program to investigate the impacts of the spill, you know, that network of scientists that was together allowed us to respond quickly to events. In 2013, there was a gas platform blowout. And because we had this coordinated network of scientists, we were able to get out there and look at what the impacts were, you know, within 36 to 48 hours after that occurred. So I think we've learned a lot from that. But, you know, there are things that incidents that happen, nothing nearly of this magnitude. Obviously, I think there's a lot of increased safeguards that have been put in place. But, you know, sometimes it doesn't mean that we're not going to see another incident happen in the future.
Well, let me take a break. We come back. We'll talk about the money the researchers received after that disaster, how important it was to figuring out the impacts, and just greater knowledge of the Gulf in general and some of the impacts on the coast, plants, animals, and ecosystems. We're talking with Dr. Brian Roberts, Executive Director and Chief Scientist at LUMCON, Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. 15th anniversary of the BP blowout, the oil just gushed into the Gulf for 87 days, if you remember those times. It was certainly different. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Dr. Brian Roberts, Executive Director and Chief Scientist at Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, 15th anniversary of the BP Horizon disaster and 87 days of oil pouring into the Gulf. Doctor, when it comes to things that change forever, that will never be the same as a result of this, what are some of those things, if there are any?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, you know, one thing you have to recognize is that, you know, the extent of the oiling was really extensive. So there's over 1,300 miles of Gulf shoreline that was oiled. Almost 700 of that was wetlands. And over 200 of those had moderate to heavy oiling, and 95% of those wetlands are in Louisiana. And Louisiana, we know, is losing land at a very rapid rate. And the oil that came ashore, you know, some places reported getting oil up to 100 meters or almost 300 feet into away from the edge. Most of it was concentrated in that 10 to 20 meter range, you know, in the 30 to 60 foot range from the edge. And where that oil was heavy, we saw very accelerated rates of land loss. Once that land is gone, I mean, the oil penetrates into the soil, it kills the roots of the plants, it can no longer trap sediment, that oil, that land then erodes away. You're not getting that back. So we saw an acceleration of land loss as a result of that oil. You know, other things may recover if they were able to make it through that initial pulse of loss, but we have a lot of these marsh that's now gone as a result of that oil spill.
Did the oil spill help you and your peers learn things that you didn't know before, that maybe there's some kind of serendipitous result?
Well, I think so. I mean, you have to recognize, I mean, there's, you know, the settlement was obviously very large. In general, it was over $20 billion. And there are programs that exist now that didn't exist before. The Gulf Research Program, the National Academies of Science, you know, that program was launched with $500 million. The NOAA Restore Act Science Program is over $130 million. The Center of Excellence that are established in each of the Gulf states, that totals $130 million as well. But the real one from a research perspective is the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative. As I mentioned, that was a 10-year program from 2010 to 2020 that was $500 million. And what that did is it funded these large consortia. So 25-plus investigators plus all their research teams were able to examine the impacts in a truly interdisciplinary way. So you can look at all the components. You know, normally, you know, people have done studies previously on the impacts of oil, and you're looking at like a plant in isolation, or you're looking at the sensitivity of a fish. But it allows you to look at things in a truly integrated way. You know, ecosystems are complicated. You know, we know oil has toxicity, and it has direct toxicity on the plants, whether you're talking on the marsh or in the water, on the invertebrates, that are there, on microbes that are responsible for cycling nutrients. It has direct impacts on all those. But because those different components are all connected, if you impact the plants, that may have another impact on the invertebrates, which then may have an impact on, you know, the birds or mammals or reptiles. And so what this allowed us to do was look at things at the whole scale, and we're able to discover a lot of things about how these systems are interconnected in terms of their sensitivity to the oiling that we wouldn't be able to do if we didn't have $50 million a year being dedicated to research on this topic. And the other thing that came out of this, I would say, is that because we had all of these researchers working together, there was a lot more synthesis and talking across projects. That was the main focus of GOMRI, was to try to bring together and figure that out. And we trained a whole generation of scientists, from undergraduates to graduate students to postdocs, early career faculty, and beyond. Some of those people actually progressed throughout each of those steps while this consortium funding of 10 years was in place.
Very interesting stuff, Doctor. I appreciate your time and your efforts. Dr. Brian Roberts, Executive Director, Chief Scientist of Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, talking about the effects of the Deepwater Horizon disaster some 15 years later. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Troy Henry. He was on with Newell yesterday. We wanted to give him a chance as well. We talked to Sidney Torres last week. Now we'll get Troy Henry's side of the French Quarter garbage story when we return here on WWL. 7:45, quarter till 8. Quickly to Troy Henry, managing partner of Henry Consulting, to get his side of the controversial French Quarter trash contract. There are often two, if not more, sides to every story. And Troy, we wanted to give you every opportunity to tell yours. I understand you were on with Newell yesterday, right?
Yeah, I was. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay. Tell me what's going on for your version of this.
Well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. As you know, last year we were part of a procurement process with the city of New Orleans. Our firm finished first. We were selected. Sidney Torres' firm finished third. Romelli was second. And we went to the city council to get approval. We did not get approval based upon, they used the excuse of had not reached an agreement with our subcontractor.
Hang one second. So you respond to the, I just want to get the steps of this, Troy, because you deal with it every day, people don't. The city puts out a request for proposals. You got to do A, B, C, and D in the French Quarter to clean it up. How much can you do this for? And then you bid, and then they open the bids, and you're the low bidder, so you get the job.
No. This is not a bid. This was an RFP, a request for proposal. So it's best value. So it's not just the lowest price wins.
Okay, all right.
It's capabilities, it's approach, equipment, whole bunch of different factors. Price is one of those factors.
So who determined that you were the best vendor for this?
There was a committee of, from the sanitation department, the CAO's office, the CFO's office. There was a team of city officials that actually made that determination.
And when was that, Troy?
That was done, I think, in July.
All right, so July. And then take me to when it comes time you go into the council trying to sign a contract?
Yeah, so there's two steps. One is we have to, first, the city gives you a award letter, which takes a little bit of time, and then we go and negotiate an agreement with the city, which took some time. You know, we have to work all through negotiating all of the business points and things of that sort. Then,
let me jump in for a second. I'm confused with how you have to negotiate agreement when the RFP, if they selected you, wouldn't the agreement already be made? What am I missing here? I'm trying to understand.
No. A bid is everything is fixed. An RFP allows for negotiations and trade-offs. In fact, the city asked us to do a little extra on a certain area. We made trade-offs on a number of different business points. It's a typical any RFP. You're going to have some business terms negotiations. You're going to have some technical negotiations, things they want, things you want, things that are better, things that are worse.
Just trying to understand the process. So you go before the council, and what happens?
So we go before the council, and at that point in time when we went before the council, we didn't have an agreement in place with our subcontract. We had a teaming agreement, but when it was time to get a subcontract, we didn't at that time have it. So the city council basically said, because you're changing your subcontract, we're not going to approve your contract. They deferred it. So as a result of that, they entered into an emergency contract, and they bid that out. That was a bid, and Torres won that bid. And so, but it was a temporary contract until our, what they said was until our parameters had been met with our subcontractor. As a result of that, Richards Disposal and I reached, and my company reached an agreement. We went back to the city council and said, we've now reached an agreement. It is time for us to begin our permanent contract and you to end the temporary contract. The city agreed, yeah, there is no more emergency. There is no more need for a temporary contract because the parties have come together. All conditions have been satisfied. Hence, Torres received a termination notice, I think it was last week, a week before last, and we're set to commence on, I think, August 1st.
So let me ask about the council and you and your subcontractor, Richards, and was there any need for the council to do that? Did you have everything in place? I'm trying to understand the process.
Yeah, we did. We actually had everything in place, and quite frankly, there were several members of the council, specifically J.P. Morrell, that were just using that as a smokescreen, because even after we got things together with my subcontract and myself, they still refused to approve our contract. So it had nothing to do with us reaching an agreement with Richard's Disposal. It really had to do with J.P. Morrell and Helena Moreno's just desire for politics.
All right, let me ask you a different way.
Go ahead.
Were you ready to go when you went to the council for the funding, and were you ever given a chance to do what you said you were going to do?
No, we weren't given a chance, but we were ready.
Okay. So you're saying that, first of all, the emergency contract should never have been let because there was no emergency?
That is correct.
Okay.
Because we had a replacement contractor, because Richards and I at that point in time had not reached an agreement, we had a replacement contractor that had already been approved and accepted by the city of New Orleans. So there was no question on our full capabilities of being able to do the job. It was just politics, and it was a way of delaying things so that they could get their friends, you know, to try and steer a contract in their friend's direction.
As they said, Oliver Thomas is doing for you. We'll take a break. We'll pick it up here when we come back, talking to Troy Henry, getting the other side of the French Quarter trash thing. Somebody wants to know about you not owning equipment or whatever, or having to do a subcontractor, but that's kind of the way business works. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, quickly back to Troy Henry with Henry Consulting, Tommy Tucker, WWL, about the contract to pick up trash in the French Quarter. Troy, just to recap, and correct me if I say anything wrong, you're saying you answered the request for proposals, a committee chose you went before the council to get the deal approved and funded, am I right so far?
To get it, not necessarily funded, but to get it approved.
To get it approved.
Part of the process, yeah.
As part of the process, and they said, well, no, you can't do it because why?
Well, the first reason was because I didn't have the original subcontract in my proposal as part of the go-forward approval process. Then the second time around, they just came up with a bunch of BS excuses, quite frankly, and it was just politics, primarily J.P. Morrell and Helena Moreno.
All right, let me get to this, because our time's running out. People are texting in about you don't own any trucks, and that hang on a second. I'm going to answer. And Sidney Torres told me that he put a bunch of million into his company, whatever. You respond to that, please, Troy.
Well, first of all, I have all of the equipment. My team has all the equipment necessary to perform, period. Between what I have and what my subcontractor, Richard's Disposal, has, we have everything we need. Second of all, Sidney Torres putting money into a contract, that's his business decision. His temporary contract clearly said it wasn't necessary. He did it on his own, and now he's whining and barking because he's been terminated. And if he really put the money in that he says he did, now he can't get the return on his investment. Hence the reason why it was a temporary contract. So, I mean, it's just bad business decisions this guy is making, and now he's bellyaching about it, as far as I can tell. We won the contract, and we're going to perform the contract.
Somebody told me something, I forgot who it is, because I talked to so many people about this, about wiping down trash cans in a French Quarter and so forth. Tell me about what Torres is doing, Sidney Torres is doing, what you're going to do as it relates to the request for proposals, and if he goes above and beyond, should the city have put that in there to begin with, or does that go back to it not being a bid and it being a request for proposals and who can offer the best value?
That's a big smokescreen. First of all, there's nothing Torres is doing that isn't already stipulated in our contract.
Okay.
Second of all, Sidney Torres bid over $3 million more than anybody else bid per year on the contract. So when you talk about value, he was nowhere near representing best value solutions for the city. This is just a loser's limp, a guy trying to do a backdoor approach, then he lost the permanent contract, and now he's trying to come through the back door to get it.
So what happens from here, Troy, legally? Because if what you're telling me is accurate, it would seem like you're on some pretty firm legal ground.
Well, we have a contract. We'll have a contract to start August 1st, and Sidney has a termination notice for the end of July. It's just that simple. He doesn't have a legal basis. He signed a contract that says, I agree to be terminated at any point in time with 90 days notice. The city has given him over 90 days notice of his termination. He has no legal basis.
For people who live in the French Quarter and visit, et cetera, are they going to notice a difference when you take over as opposed to what Sidney Torres is doing now?
I think it'll be better.
Tell me why.
Quite frankly. I'm sorry, say it again.
Tell me why.
No, we the professionalism of our team, what Sidney has done at this point in time is just overhyped himself. What you'll see, what we've done in the DDD already, and CBD, as you saw during the Super Bowl, no hitches, immaculate downtown. That was us. That wasn't Sidney Torres. That's Henry Consulting does all of the CBD in downtown. We'll provide that level of professionalism, that level of performance, and more with brand new equipment across the board as required by the city.
So what happens from here? We got 30 seconds left.
August 1st, we start working.
All right. Thank you, Troy. I appreciate your time. And, I don't have a horse in this race. I really don't. I'm just trying to figure out what's
politics.
True and what's not. I think there is a lot of politics involved in a lot of different things.
Yeah,
when's
the last time you saw public official advertising for a contract for a company like Sidney Torres, like Billy Nungesser did, running actual TV ads?
Right.
It's corrupt.
Thank you, Troy. Appreciate it. We'll be back. WWO.